This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Hello, pet lovers. Welcome to Best Bets for Pets. I'm your show host, Michelle Fern. Today, okay, if you have a pet or if you've thought about a pet or if you have an animal that you've even seen down the street, you're going to love today's show. We are going to talk to the two authors of an incredible book. You do not want to miss this. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Take a bite out of your competition. Advertise your business with an ad in Pet Life Radio podcasts and radio shows. There is no other pet-related media that is as large and reaches more pet parents and pet lovers than Pet Life Radio. With over 7 million monthly listeners, Pet Life Radio podcasts are available on all major podcast platforms. And our live radio stream goes out to over 250 million subscribers on iHeartRadio, Odyssey, TuneIn, and other streaming apps. For more information on how you can advertise on the number one pet podcast and radio network, visit PetLifeRadio.com/advertise today.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com.
I'd like to welcome today my guests, Bill Wasik. He's the editorial director of the New York Times Magazine, and Monica Murphy. She's a veterinarian and writer, and they are both the authors of Our Kindred Creatures, How Americans Came to Feel the Way They Do About Animals. Welcome, Bill and Monica.
Hi there.
Thank you.
This is some book. This is incredible. And it's not what I thought it would be from the title. Basically, the book is about the creation of the ASPCA, the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and its founder, at least that's where it starts, you know, in the beginning. And just the history in it is amazing. What inspired you to write Our Kindred Creatures?
Well, stepping back, so we're married and I am an editor and journalist, has been my career, and Monica's a veterinarian, and we decided about 10 years ago to write a book about the history of rabies. And we had such a fun experience doing that, that we were looking for another and kind of bigger subject to write about. And we got very interested in late 19th century America, where, you know, as the country is changing so much, as the way people live is changing so much, people's relationship with animals was changing in this remarkable way. And that happens to be exactly when Henry Berg founds the ASPCA. And that touches off a movement that very quickly spreads. You have these societies all around the country. And in the process, it bumps up against all these other ways that our relationships with animals were changing. You have P.T. Barnum exhibiting animals, many animals that people have never seen for the first time. And then that in turn flows into the circus, the railroad-driven circuses. You have medical research on animals. You have the early veterinary medicine. The scientific veterinary medicine really starts during that time period. And then you also have things like threatening species, people sort of realizing that animals are going extinct, as well as the rise of the industrial meat industry, which really takes animals out of human society and puts them sort of in a system where people are less aware of what's happening to them. So the more we got into it, the more we realized that, wow, this is just such a fascinating period in American history, and that we wanted to do a book that really tried to braid all those different stories and kind of show how they all fit together.
It's amazing that you were able to make it all fit together, because there is so much information. And as you talked about it, I was, you know, I read the book and I was thinking it definitely does. It weaves through, you know, everything kind of weaves through. And it's interesting how one thing led to another. And there was so much going on at that time in the U.S. Most of it is based in the U.S. There's some things that occurred in Europe. A lot of it starts, at least, with Henry Berg, who was the founder of the ASPCA. What inspired him, and why did you focus on Henry Berg and his founding of the ASPCA?
Well, even at the time and still today, Henry Berg is seen as this singular person who brought this movement to the United States. It had already begun in Europe, but until Henry Berg decided to make this his pet project, there was no animal welfare movement in the United States. And he sort of had the idea that he was going to take this on at a moment when others were maybe feeling the same thing, but he made himself very quickly a public figure, an interesting public figure who fascinated his contemporaries as he fought this fight and brought the questions of animal welfare and suffering into the foreground, or as an issue that people could do something about.
You know, it was an interesting time in this country because cities were overpopulated and we did have a lot of influx of people coming in from other countries. So there were a lot of challenges within cities because everything was seemed to be sectionalized. There was, you know, the Irish section, the Jewish section, the Italian section. There was challenges with that and with language. And then there was very rural settings where, however, animals were treated, they weren't viewed as much because the areas were so rural. There was a lot that was going on with animals that today, I mean, we've come a long way. Just in the last 50 years, we've come a long way with animal welfare. But some of the things were incredible. So in your research and writing, why do you think the things that were going on were going on? I mean, people were using mostly horses then. Horses were abused like crazy. There was dog fighting for entertainment, cock fighting, you know, roosters, cocks, and riding and fighting for entertainment as well. So why were these things going on? And then what kind of challenges did Henry Berg face?
Well, it's a little bit of a mixed picture. And the horses, which were the focus of Henry Berg's initial movement, were very much a part of urban life at the time. A lot of us looking back on the 19th century imagine that as the Industrial Revolution got started, horses were sort of immediately swept from the streets. But the opposite is really true. As urbanization and industrialization sort of swept in, it brought more horses to the streets because even with the advent of new technologies, steam engines and railroads, you still needed horses to haul the coal, to feed the railroads and feed the steam engines. You had a highly mobile society who needed to move around a lot more. And so that meant horses clotting the streets, moving people, moving commercial goods. You know, this is before refrigeration. So you have horses bringing the milk every day. You have horses bringing information. So it really put humans and horses in close company in a sort of new way because of the density of cities. And with density, sometimes, you know, there can be conflict. So the horses are a sort of special and urgent case for the early animal welfare movement. But you're right, there's lots of other animals in the mix in cities then. I mean, this is a time when companion animals, dogs and cats, were really at large, sort of moving independently through the city. The practice of letting your poultry or your pig that you're raising for food kind of maneuver about the city and scratch out their own living with some freedom, that hadn't gone away entirely yet. And families still might have a dairy goat or cow stashed behind their building. There was a really sort of rich multi-species environment back then. And so that really did mean there was a lot of work for the early animal welfare to do.
Something I found interesting too is the horses were the beginning of the veterinary industry.
Yes. Well, they were valuable to people.
Right.
So I think early veterinary medicine certainly understood that there were emotional ties between people and animals too, but a lot of what motivated people to call a veterinarian to help is the fact that they needed their animals to earn their living. So that sort of economic driver for veterinary medicine, I think, was really, really important. It allowed veterinarians to charge a living wage, you know, for themselves to people who needed help with their animals. And because they could earn a good living. It meant that people were willing to pay to go to school and get an education to be qualified to do that work. And so the emotional bond between humans and animals meant that even as horses later would go away, veterinary medicine would continue to be important. But early on, I don't think the early veterinarians really dreamed that their work could take place just based on that.
So one of the really interesting things that we see happen during the time period that we're researching is you can really see the evolution of veterinary medicine as people become more, not just willing, but sort of desperate to have their dogs and cats seen. So in the 1880s, you start to see these news stories about, you know, a veterinary clinic in Brooklyn, where, you know, a lady took her Angora cat who was sick and came in to visit it every day while it was in the hospital, et cetera. That doesn't exist at all during the beginning of our time period. But by the end, you know, more among the wealthy who could afford to pay, but you definitely begin to see the rise of the kind of pet keeping that we value and experience today.
So interesting. What else I found interesting too is how overpopulation was dealt with, because these days we're all about to do whatever we can to reduce euthanizing. Mostly it's dogs and cats. Then is there a humane way to, you know, kill? I mean, it's horrible to think that you have to kill, but there was a lot of overpopulation then with dogs and cats just roaming the streets. And this movement even change that. Dogs at one point were, you know, put in a box and just all together alive were put in a box, and the box was just, you know, held underwater with a rock. So you read that and it's horrifying, but that was the norm then, if I'm calling correctly, right? And
right.
And today somebody would be arrested if they did something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a big change of this era. Yeah.
Right. Well, remember that this is before spay and neuter surgeries were available to right. to pet owners. And as a consequence of the way animals were kept and all the freedom they had and the fact that they weren't spayed or neutered, the sort of inevitable explosion in numbers of animals really did create bitter challenges for people who loved animals. So that, yes, the early animal welfare reformers, they gave attention to the problem of unwanted dogs and cats who didn't have homes and weren't receiving enough to eat. They couldn't imagine a world in which they could sort of place all of them in loving families. They really did agonize about how they could kindly and humanely end their lives rather than see them suffer and starve outside.
One of the protagonists of our book, even though during this time period it was not very friendly for women who wanted to be leaders in organizations, there was this woman named Carolyn Earle White in Philadelphia, who was really one of the sort of big figures of the animal welfare movement of that day. She was instrumental in founding the Pennsylvania Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And one of the things that she's remembered for is her group. She had a group of a women's branch sort of within that Pennsylvania SPCA, and they created the nation's first humane animal shelter. And at the time, you know, it was ridiculed in part because it was run by women, but also the idea that you should have a nice home for stray animals to go to was seen as sort of, you know, frilly feminine thing. But of course, it was an innovation that became a big part of the movement for animals. You know, they did practice euthanasia, but they put a lot of time and effort into figuring out the most humane form of euthanasia that was available to them. And they actually sent another one of the leaders, George Angel, was traveling in Europe, and they sent him all around to European cities that had worked on humane animal care to figure out what was the most humane method of euthanasia that they could use. So yeah, that's another thing that happens during this time period, is you see basically the rise of the animal shelter.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and we're going to come right back and talk more about your book, Our Kindred Creatures. We'll be right back. Hey everyone, Michelle Fern here. Are you looking to enhance your pet's health, wellness, and longevity? Since they can't communicate their feelings directly, Prosper Canine can help bridge the gap. Their simple cheek swab tests allow you to monitor your dog's health and well-being effortlessly.
At Prosper Canine, they use cutting-edge technology to analyze genetics, breed, and the groundbreaking field of epigenetics. This means you can understand how your dog is aging, how stress affects them, and even their oral health status, which helps you stay ahead of conditions like gingivitis and bad breath. Take proactive steps towards your dog's health today. Visit Prosper Canine and order your test kits to start making informed decisions for your furry friend's well-being. Enter Best Bets and get 10% off all products at ProsperCanine.com. Prosper, the letter K, and number 9.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking to Bill Wasik and Monica Murphy, the authors of Our Kindred Creatures, which is an incredible book. So George Angel, he created Our Dumb Animals, which was a very popular newspaper. But just to put into perspective what we were talking about earlier, as far as, you know, dealing with humane ways for overpopulation and things like that. So this will give our listening audience a little bit of a perspective here. The ASPCA was almost the precursor for the prevention of cruelty to children. So yeah, that's mind-blowing. Can you talk about that? Because I found that to be just so interesting.
Yeah. And you know, and another aspect of this that's related that I think a lot of people today really boggles their mind is that the ASPCA was a private group, but when they started, they were given essentially police power to go and arrest people themselves on the street and take them to a court in front of a judge. And what I think is true of sort of both of those stories is that in the present day, it's just really hard for us to understand how little the government did relative to what we think of as governments doing today. There were police forces in these cities, but they tended to be more sort of like people just out on the street who maintained order in the moment. They didn't necessarily think that much about investigating crime or fighting crime unless they saw it happen. That pretty much came later. And so if you wanted to have a deliberate campaign to stop people from abusing animals, the feeling was that this private organization had to do it. And so the fact that that didn't exist for children immediately became, people became more aware of the fact that this was another huge way in which the law was not being used properly, and that, you know, there were lots of people who were abusing their children and something had to be done. And so Henry Berg, and this, I think that this year is maybe the 150th anniversary, 1874, I think. Is that 150 years?
Check.
But it's a very famous case, the Mary Ellen case. And it was a case in New York where somebody told Henry Berg about this case and he decided, you know what, we're going to act here. And so he sent the ASPCA's agents to go and retrieve a girl who was being abused, and she won her case. And in the aftermath of that, they started the New York Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children. The final mind-blowing thing that I think is in some ways even crazier is that in New York, in the states that already had these SPCAs, the prosecution were considering the cruelty to animals and children was separate. But in many, many cities, especially that had the name Humane Society, if you hear the name Humane Society, those organizations were typically founded for both animals and children. So you would have the same organizations and sometimes the same agents who would be policing and helping to prosecute cases of cruelty to both animals and children.
That's crazy. That's unbelievable. Another section of the book, another chapter, you talk about slaughterhouses. So a way to make slaughterhouses more humane, which it's a slaughterhouse. So that's, it's kind of taboo, a little. And as I was reading it, I'm very much a big of, you know, thought of my personal view. I don't like to push my views on anyone. And I'm not vegan, but close to it. But you read this and think, I don't think I could ever even watch anything like that again. But yeah, it was incredible that they thought, let's make the slaughterhouses more humane. And then in doing so, they made the slaughterhouses actually safer.
Yeah. So our book is a story, we think a lot of story of success, right? This generation of activists for animals like really did help the animals of the United States. But there are other ways in which it's a story, not exactly a failure, but of sort of battles that were not totally won. And I definitely would say that that, I think, is the lesson that we're trying to get across about the way that animals were treated. You know, you did have slaughterhouses in cities where Henry Berg, you know, would go and he would see just how cruelly they were treating the animals when they slaughtered them, and he would prosecute them just like he did anybody else. But what really is happening during this time period is in places, mostly in the Midwest, places like Chicago is the one we write about, but also Cincinnati, and I think St. Louis and some other places, you have the rise of this very concentrated, very sort of industrial approach to raising and slaughtering animals. And they weren't necessarily crueler than the previous slaughterhouses that you would find all around the country, but they didn't really care very much about cruelty. And it turned out that it was much harder for these SPCAs to really inspect them or understand what was going on. They didn't really have the authority to do that. And it just wasn't really how they thought about their mission. And so during just between, say, 1870 and the middle of the 1890s, you just have this phenomenal explosion of the number of cows and pigs that are coming through Chicago slaughterhouses. And there's all sorts of evidence. You know, a very famous book called The Jungle by Upton Sinclair shows sort of what it was like to be inside these slaughterhouses. It was very, you know, there was just blood everywhere and the animals were screaming. Anyway, not to get into it, but the animal welfare advocates weren't really able to police that. And I think today's slaughterhouses are definitely better than those. But it is still the case that because the process of slaughtering the animals, and for that matter, creating the milk and laying the eggs, because all of that is happening off in the distance from us where we can't see it, we really don't, I think, spare enough of a thought for just how many animals are sort of confined into these lives where they are forced to produce stuff for human beings, and they're not very nice existences. And I do think that that's an example of a kind of a war that these animal welfare advocates sort of tried to fight, but didn't really get as far as I think they could have.
Thank you for that great explanation. You talk a lot about P.T. Barnum and the circus, of which I don't think, is there a circus even in the U.S. anymore? I think
There are some circuses, but nothing with the sort of big name like Barnum.
Right. And I think I saw that. I'm not 20-something, so I saw that circus as a kid. But we've changed a lot, even in the last 20, 30 years. But there was a lot going on with P.T. Barnum, too.
Sure. Well, P.T. Barnum was a major figure in the time period that we write about. Before the circus, he had a big museum in New York City that was a major tourist attraction. Everybody went. Lincoln went. And it was a sort of catch-all kind of museum that sort of mixed history and, I don't know, fake stuff and like celebrity waxworks, but also live animals. And it was a real spectacle. And it was how a lot of people in New York City, certainly, and probably even people visiting New York City, first encountered a lot of exotic species. And there's a lot of terrible details available about how those animals lived inside Barnum's museum and later in his circuses. But it also is a place where, well, thanks to P.T. Barnum and his publicity team, he really sort of gave names and personalities and whole backstories and histories to these animals and captured the imagination of a lot of people about sort of specific celebrity animals. And that was a first, I think, for this country and maybe beyond that. And it certainly is interesting. And that idea of sort of celebrity animals and animals as spectacle, that's still with us. And he was a big originator of that. in this country.
And a lover of animals in his way.
That's true, too. Because the flip side of P.T. Barnum is that he had lots of interest in trying to keep those animals going and relatively healthy. And he knew more than a lot of the people he kind of butted heads with on the animal welfare side about how to take good care of them, sort of in the confines of these human spaces. And he, you know, when he went head to head with Henry Berg, time and time again, he usually seemed to come out on top because he knew his animals and he knew what they needed and much better than the animal welfare guys did.
And at that time, the circus, it wasn't seen as, the animals weren't seen as being, you know, handled cruelly.
There were people who objected to how the animals were handled at the time. There were even some contemporaries who found fault with Henry Berg for not doing more to take on P.T. Barnum. But yeah, in general, there wasn't too much concern with how the animals were being handled in outfits like P.T. Barnum's.
Okay. I talked about this very briefly, but George Angel wrote Our Dumb Animals. What was that?
So he was, as the head of the Massachusetts SPCA, he turned their kind of house publication, which was called Our Dumb Animals, sort of a funny name, but, you know, at the time was what they meant, of course, was profound, which is that animals, because they can't speak, it puts an obligation on us to speak for them. And so he created this essentially a magazine, and it had news of the society, but it also had little stories, little fictional stories. It had poetry, it had art, it had little inspirational essays. And it really, it was part of his long career as a kind of inspirational, almost sort of evangelical figure who was trying to convert people to, you know, to kindness. And he really was focused on women and children. He really thought that the home, you know, the schools, that childhood, these were the places to mold people into being kind, not just to animals, but to people. And that was a big believer of not just him, but other people of this time, is that one big reason to preach kindness to animals is it would actually encourage people to be kind in all aspects of their life.
Yes, that's wonderful. Like I said, this is an amazing book, and we've just given a very fast overview, barely got into, you know, because there's just so much information. We've come a long way in our treatment of animals, and you touch on this right at the end of your book with some of the foods that we have. You know, back then, you know, I think probably your dog and cat, if you were not super wealthy, they ate whatever the garbage table scraps were there. Now we cook for them, and they are eating these fancy foods that can cost upwards of, you know, $300 a month. So we've come a long way. What would you tell our listening audience why it's important for people to read Our Kindred Creatures?
Well, we hope to connect with readers who, like us, like love animals and love history and some science and technology stuff too, sort of find some storytelling in our book. So that's the main reason. But we also think that this story of what happened and the way people so quickly changed how they think about animals is a sort of case study in how people and societies and cultures can change. I mean, this was a real radical shift going from, you know, not really considering how animals felt much at all to really like being aware of it. And I think that has important lessons, you know, for those of us who can imagine an even better world than the one we have now.
I love that. So where can people find your book?
Well, anywhere that books are sold, we hope, you know, certainly online, at whether it's at Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or, you know, there's a place called bookshop.org. That's a great place to give money to independent bookstores when you buy online. We are also doing some events. We're going to be in New York, Seattle, Portland, Oregon, Brookline, Massachusetts,
Washington
D.C., and Nashville, Tennessee. And so those are all coming up soon.
Well, I wish you great success with this book. It's a fascinating book. And thank you so much for coming on Best Bets for Pets.
Thanks for having us.
I hope you all enjoyed this show. This has been one of the most amazing books about animals that I've ever read. Again, it's Our Kindred Creatures, How Americans Came to Feel the Way They Do About Animals by Bill Wastick and Monica Murphy, an incredible book about the history of animals starting in late 19th century. Just incredible. I want to thank my crew that they always let me know that they are treated well and they need to be even spoiled even more. That's Molly, Charlotte, and Dennis. And of course, a huge thanks to everyone listening to Best Bets for Pets. I appreciate it so much. Thank you so much, Bill and Monica, for coming on the show. And a huge thank you to my producer, Mark Winter, for working his magic and making me and my guests sound amazing. And hey, keep listening, because you never know what we're going to have next on Best Bets for Pets.
Let's Talk Pets every week on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.